You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi. The race for the Astoria City Council seat that represents the core downtown area is firming up. Incumbent Elizabeth Adams is officially in the running again, and she may face a challenger. KMUN's Katie Frankowitz reports.
Local photographer Justin Grafton grew up in Astoria. He's worked in heavy construction and served on the local United Way board. He says he would bring strong connections with Clatsop County and Astoria-based nonprofits and organizations, such as Clatsop Community Action and Helping Hands Reentry. He told KMUN he had been considering running for some time.
I have a really good pulse of, I think, what locals and what people moving here like about Astoria, and I think I can connect those dots. And so I'm hoping to be able to get in there in Liz's seat and help fulfill some of that. I think most of what we're dealing with a lot of is just lack of communication. I feel like we need a little bit more transparency so that people understand the decisions that are being made locally to help benefit Astoria and not hurt all the time. And I think sometimes it gets lost in the noise. And I'm pretty good at helping people see through that noise.
Like several other candidates in races for seats on the Astoria City Council, Grafton points to the city's permitting process and how it works with developers and contractors as issues he'd be looking to address. He says he's not necessarily running in opposition to Adams, and that when he began the filing process, he didn't realize she was already planning to run again. But Grafton is not officially Adams' opponent yet. He is in the middle of collecting and verifying voter signatures that he needs in order to get on the ballot. Adams owns Wild Roots Movement and Massage. She was elected in 2022, beating her opponent, contractor Chris Hafker. She replaced former Ward 3 City Councilor Joan Herman, who had chosen not to run for re-election to the five-member council. Adams grew up in Swenson and in her 2022 campaign focused on her past experience as an advocate for people in poverty and for health and human services. She says many of her priorities around providing these services and advocating for small businesses and working parents remain the same. She hopes to also continue council work that has taken her beyond Astoria.
One of the things I've been working on, and we just recently worked on at council and work session, was creating legislative priorities. I've been able to go to Salem and lobby for infrastructure funding for our water sewer treatment plant, some other lobbying I've done for our community. And those relationships are really important because money is very scarce and it's hard to find. And our city does an incredible job with grant funding, but we need help from the legislative perspective. So I'm going to continue to work on those relationships and ensure that they know how desperate and how important it is to pay attention to Astoria's infrastructure.
Adams says it took her a while to decide to seek out a second four-year term. At one point, she had thought she might run for mayor, or for county or state office, but she settled back on her Ward 3 seat.
The first term is when you really just kind of get started, and the second term is when you're really able to flourish and come into your role even more confidently. And I think a second term for me would be an incredible time to move a lot of policy and legislation and really start working on the things that I've wanted to work on in the very beginning. And that's really systematically changing the way that the public has interfaced with the city.
Like Grafton, she also has concerns about the functioning of the city's permitting system. Recently, Adams was vocal in the push to suspend a portion of the city's system development charges, noting the impacts on new businesses. System development charges are an attempt to make developers help share the cost burden of key infrastructure as they increase the potential demand. Adams also voted in favor of a controversial exclusion zone policy that would temporarily ban certain people from the downtown area if they repeatedly broke the law and city rules around public camping. A majority of the city council voted down her and Mayor Sean Fitzpatrick. Adams later worked with Councilor Andrea Mazzarella to develop the Shelter First policy, a multi-pronged approach to addressing homeless camps downtown that focuses on directing people to services. It also involved the hiring of a new homeless liaison to work with people on the streets. Despite her unity with Mayor Fitzpatrick in the exclusion zone vote, during her time on the city council, Adams has often clashed with the mayor. back-and-forth discussions have revealed division between the two city leaders, differences of opinion and personality that Adams acknowledges and says matter. She says they're both passionate people.
I think that passion sometimes can also can definitely create some tension, especially when there is disagreement. I think some of that is very healthy in a council. And I think some of that is what we want to see, but we want to also see respectful outcomes to those conversations and that tension.
Fitzpatrick is not seeking a second term. He ran unopposed for the office in 2022. This November, there could be three candidates for voters to choose from. The filing deadline for prospective city council candidates closes next week. Any challengers for Adams' Ward 3 seat will need to have been a resident of Astoria for the 6 months preceding the November 3rd election. They must be a registered voter and currently live in the Ward 3 area. They also must submit a petition signed by 13 registered voters who live in Ward 3. Oregon State Police have released information about a fatal crash that closed down U.S. Highway 30 approximately 16 miles east of Astoria for about 5 hours Tuesday afternoon. A preliminary investigation shows that a pickup truck operated by 73-year-old Roger Dale McGilvey of Ocean Park, Washington, was heading eastbound on the highway. He rear-ended a sedan operated by 86-year-old Benny Roy Parker of Astoria. Parker had stopped and was waiting to turn onto Valley Creek Lane from Highway 30. The crash pushed his car into the westbound lane, where it was struck by a car driven by another Ocean Park resident. Parker was ejected from his vehicle and pronounced dead at the scene. McGilvey, who had rear-ended Parker, suffered serious injuries and was taken to a local hospital. I'm Katie Frankowitz, reporting. You're listening to news on KMUN.
New filings in Oregon Youth Authority sex abuse lawsuits allege a long-term cover-up. 13 former Youth Authority staff submitted sworn statements describing years of sexual abuse by a long-term agency physician. They accused Youth Authority leaders of knowing about the abuse and doing nothing. The statements add fresh weight to a group of pending lawsuits alleging Dr. Edward Gary Edwards sexually abused young men in his care from 2000 to 2017. Perhaps the most prominent individual named in the lawsuits is Faribors Paksharest, who ran the Youth Authority from 2012 to 2017. Paksharest later led the Oregon Department of Human Services, and most recently was appointed as the interim director of the Oregon Health Authority last month. It is an inopportune time for the state to try to settle what could be very expensive litigation. The latest $49 million settlement was so large the state had to defer most of the payout because of a lack of funds. The plaintiffs in the case have been divided into groups for the trial, with the first group set for November 2nd. This story comes to us through a news partnership with Oregon Journalism Project and was reported on by Nigel J. Quiss. Online at OregonJournalismProject.org. Oregon lost about 4,100 jobs last month, but the state's overall unemployment rate remained roughly the same. In a Wednesday news release, the Oregon Employment Department reported that professional and business services were on a slightly downward trend. Leisure and hospitality is also employing fewer people than average. State employment economist Gail Krummenauer said some industries are seeing change, but Oregon's overall unemployment rate has remained steady at 5.2%.
We've seen very little change in the size of the labor force or in the number of unemployed Oregonians. Now, our unemployment rate is a little bit higher than the U.S., which was at 4.1% in July, but we haven't seen any substantial change in Oregon's unemployment rate for more than a year now.
Retail was one of the few industries that reported gains last month, with about 500 jobs, though that industry overall has seen declining employment over the last several years.
Oregon's public colleges and universities are in financial trouble, and higher education leaders say things could get worse. OPB's Bryce Dole reports.
Governor Tina Kotek is now considering a $4.4 billion higher education budget. Inflation, rising labor costs, and declining enrollment are among the challenges colleges and universities face. And that's already affecting students and staff, prompting layoffs and difficult union negotiations. Higher education leaders are also warning of tuition hikes and steeper cuts to programs. Richard Devlin, a former state lawmaker, says the state is underfunding its colleges and universities.
Because I think our ability to meet the needs of students and parents and the state is diminishing on a yearly basis.
The legislature decides on the state's budget next year. Lawmakers will face competing demands, including funding for transportation, education, and social services. I'm Bryce Dole, reporting.
5 years ago, a construction crew stumbled upon a prehistoric artifact under a busy street in Corvallis. KLCC's Macy Moore reports on how this piece of history ended up on display in the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library.
When you're driving down 9th Street in Corvallis, you might not be aware of what's lying underneath. But right where I'm standing, just off of Linden Avenue and 9th Street, something historic was discovered back in 2021. That's when a construction crew that was supposed to be digging up a natural gas pipeline found a 12,000-year-old mammoth tusk instead. Jeff McConnell remembers getting the call. He's a Corvallis Public Works city engineer and says it's common practice to take a closer look at any strange findings. While the Northwest Natural Gas crew was digging with an excavator, the bucket started bringing up an unusual material.
So there's teeth on the bucket that help to dig, and one of the teeth scraped the side and another one broke through the tusk, and it brought up this kind of chalky material, so they knew they hit something.
McConnell contacted Oregon State University anthropology professor Lauren Davis, who had past experience preserving artifacts in the Willamette Valley.
And I asked him, how hard would it be for Public Works to remove this, excavate it, and try to preserve it?
It would take time, but Davis was willing to help. They agreed to excavate the tusk the next summer, and Davis would use it as a project for his anthropology grad students.
We buried the tusk in sand and put plywood over the top of it, and then planned for the next summer to come back and give Lauren some time to have his students come out, excavate the tusk.
Davis says he and the students spent 3 days in the hole, cleaning up the tusk and determining the best method of removal.
And then I worked to put plaster-soaked burlap around the tusk to give it some support. Basically, we were creating a cast, like if you had a broken arm, you put a cast on it, and we wanted to support it.
Once you remove the weight of the dirt and sediment, the tusk can start to crack. Casting prevented this and allowed the preservation crew to lift it out of the ground. Davis noticed the rest of the tusk seemed to extend into parts of the street that were not dug up during the gas pipeline project. What does that mean?
If there is more of the animal, then it actually is still under the street in Corvallis. It extends into the other lanes.
Once excavated, the tusk was left in the plaster encasing to slowly dry out for 2 years, which prevents peeling and cracking. Davis and a group of graduate students then coated the tusk in a preserving agent and built a plaster support around it. With the tusk ready for display, Public Works contacted the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library. Library Director Ashley Chavez says she jumped at the opportunity to showcase a unique piece of Corvallis history.
The big idea was for it to be in a place that was accessible by all people, where people could just come in and have a chance to see it and experience kind of the excitement of seeing, you know, the tusks that had been under 9th Street.
Chavez says seeing the reactions to the new tusk exhibit has been the best part.
People just kind of really taking joy in being able to see this cool piece of our history.
The 12,700-year-old Columbian mammoth tusk is now on display. You can find it just off the lobby next to the children's section. In Corvallis, I'm Macy Moore, reporting.
You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. Now moving to news from Washington State. The results of the recent primary in Washington's Congressional District 3 offer insight into how November 3rd's pivotal general election may go. District 3 represents the southernmost part of western Washington. In Pacific County, Democrats polled the highest share of the vote the party has received in a congressional primary since 2008. while incumbent District 3 Representative Marie Glusenkamp-Perez, a Democrat, pulled in 39% of the vote, 55% of all votes countywide went to one of three Democrats on the ballot. Glusenkamp-Perez will face Republican State Senator John Braun in the November election. Notable shifts in Democratic support trended strongest in the northern part of Pacific County, an area that has been drifting away from the Democratic Party over the last decade. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer, online at chinookobserver.com. Local and regional news is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Team. For more local and regional news, go to kmun.org/news. American Democracy Minute is up next. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. President Trump again recently condemned mail-in voting, used by an estimated 30% of Americans in the 2024 election, as inherently corrupt. Yet the president voted by mail August 13th in Florida's state primary, the fifth time since 2017 he's used mail-in voting. Trump has disparaged mail-in ballots, particularly universal mail-in ballots, to cast doubt on the 2020 election results and perpetuate conspiracy theories among his followers. To be clear, election officials and the courts have found no evidence of widespread mail-in or other voter fraud anywhere in the United States. In addition to the August 18th Florida primary, Newsweek reports the president voted by mail in the March 2026 Florida special election, the 2020 Florida primary, in the 2018 New York State midterm, and the 2017 New York City mayoral election. The president told a Memphis roundtable on crime and public safety in March, "I call it mail-in cheating, and we've got to do something about it all," unquote. That something includes his March executive order on elections and the Save America Act, both containing provisions severely restricting mail-in voting. Those provisions would end universal mail-in voting in eight states and disenfranchise far more eligible voters than prevent illegal ones. We've linked to more reporting at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.